questioned goal of making ham reddish. For centuries, different types of salts were recognized by taste. The Great Salt Lake was clearly a concentration of sodium chloride because it had a pleasant, salty taste, whereas the bitter, nauseous taste of the Dead Sea indicated magnesium chloride. The long-practiced principle of evaporating brine was that when brine becomes supersaturated, when it is at least 26% salt, which is considerably more than the 2.5 or 3% salt of seawater, sodium chloride crystallizes and falls out, or precipitates, from the liquid. But slowly it was discovered that after the sodium chloride, the salt of primary interest, precipitates, a variety of other salts crystallize at even denser saturation. In 1678, Dr. Thomas Rastell of Droitwich wrote, "Besides the white salt above spoken of, we have another sort called clod salt, which adheres to the bottom of the vats and which, after the white salt is laded out, is digged up with a steel picker. This is the strongest salt I have seen and is most used for salting bacon and neats, ox tongues. It makes the bacon redder than other salt and makes the fat meat firm." The word chemistry was first used in the early 1600s, although the science was not considered an independent field of research until the end of the century. One of the accomplishments of early chemists had been to identify some of the salts that precipitated out of brine. But despite this work, it seems that very few people in the 17th century had any idea what a salt was. A 1636 book by Bernard Palissy, with the dreamy title, How to Become Rich and the True Way in Which Every Man in France Could Grow and Multiply Their Treasury and Possessions, states that sugar is a salt. In listing all the various salts, Palissy includes grape salt, which gives taste and flavor to wine. It is not surprising that he concluded that it was impossible to list all the salts. In John Evelyn's 1699 Discourse on Salads, he states that sugar is sometimes referred to as Indian salt. Apparently, there was little definition of salt other than as something made of white crystals. This began to change in the early 17th century, when Johann Rudolf Glauber, a German chemist, took a cure in a spring near Vienna and extracted from the water a salt that he called sal mirabile. The salt was hydrated sodium sulfate, though Glauber could not have put it that way, because Davy had not yet discovered sodium. Glauber sold his discovery as a secret cure, a mineral bath of allegedly wondrous health benefits. It became so famous that today, though it is more used in metallurgy, textiles, and other industries than as a bath salt, it is still commonly known as Glauber's salt. Enough of an entrepreneur to keep his formula secret, Glauber was also enough of a scientist to reveal, after his fortune was made, that when sulfuric acid was applied to common salt, producing hydrochloric acid, a process that had already been well known for centuries, the residue that had always been thrown out was Glauber's salt. Later in the same century, Nehemiah Grew, a British plant physiologist who was credited with being the first human ever to witness and document plants having sex, studied the celebrated health spring water of Epsom in Surrey, England. He isolated a salt, magnesium sulfate, ever after known as Epsom salt. Epsom salt is now used not only medicinally, but in the textile industry, for explosives, in matchheads, and in fireproofing. But Nehemiah Grew was even less forthcoming than Glauber about his discovery. Only after years of speculation was it discovered by chemist Caspar Neumann in 1715 that Epsom salt could be made by applying sulfuric acid to the mother liquor. Mother liquor is the dark blood-red water that remains after common salt precipitates out of brine. An 18th-century London chemist named John Brown discovered that Epsom salt could be boiled out of the mother liquor without sulfuric acid. Brown also found another salt in the liquid. The study of this third salt, now known to be magnesium chloride, unleashed a chain of discoveries, including Davy's 1808 announcement that he had found a new element, magnesium. In 1828, Antoine Bussy isolated workable quantities of the metal, and an industry was born. Magnesium is used to prevent corrosion of steel and in explosives, light bulbs, and lightweight metal alloys. At the time of Newman's early 18th century experiments with mother liquor, the liquid was called bittern, and salt makers usually threw it away or fed it to animals, or even poor people as a cheap source of salt. The Dutch found that it worked well for washing windows. Despite pleas from scientists, most salt works continued to throw out their leftover bittern. Then, in 1792, sodium carbonate, soda, was made from mother liquor. Soda found in nature had been used since ancient times in early industries such as glassmaking. Natron is a form of soda. In fact, Davy named sodium after soda because it was one of the element's best-known compounds. The manufacture of artificial soda started numerous industries. Sodium hydrogen carbonate, bicarbonate of soda, is used in food as well as for glassmaking and textiles. Sodium carbonate is used in making paper, plastics, detergents, and the artificial fabric rayon. By the time of the Civil War, commercially made soda was common, and soda fountains had already become widespread in America. A popular American women's magazine gave a recipe for making carbonated drinks. Put into a tumbler lemon, raspberry, strawberry, pineapple, or any other acid syrup, sufficient in quantity to flavor the beverage very highly. Then pour in very cold ice water till the glass is half full. Add half a teaspoonful of bicarbonate of soda, to be obtained at the druggist's, and stir it well in with a teaspoon. It will foam up immediately and must be drank during the effervescence. By keeping the syrup and the carbonate of soda in the house, and mixing them as above with ice water, you can at any time have a glass of this very pleasant drink, precisely similar to that which you get at the shops. The cost will be infinitely less. Godey's Ladies' Book, 1860. For many centuries, there had been a great confusion between potash and soda. The name potash is derived from the process used for making potassium carbonate, cooking down water and wood ash in earthen pots. Like soda, potash had many industrial applications long before it was chemically understood. Among other things, it was used in making glass and soap. Before sodium carbonate, in the form of baking soda, was manufactured, potash was used in baking. Emilius Simmons' cookbook, originally published in Hartford and then Albany in 1796, is considered the first American cookbook not only because it was published after the Revolution, but because it was written by an American for Americans. Simmons used enormous quantities for apparently huge cakes. One recipe, for Independence Cake, called for 20 pounds of flour, 15 pounds of sugar, 10 pounds of butter, and 24 eggs. Many of her baking recipes called for pearl ash, which was potash, as a rising agent. Honey cake. 6 pound flour, 2 pound honey, 1 pound sugar, 2 ounces cinnamon, 1 ounce ginger, a little orange peel, 2 teaspoons pearl ash, 6 eggs. Dissolve the pearl ash in milk, put the whole together, moisten with milk if necessary, bake 20 minutes. Amelia Simmons, American Cookery, 1796. In 1807, when the potash industry was already many centuries old, Davy connected a piece of potash to the poles of a battery and caused the release of a metal at the negative pole. According to his cousin Edmund, Davy began dancing around the room in ecstasy, realizing that he had isolated another element. He named his newly discovered metal potassium, after potash. Until the late 18th century, bleaching was accomplished by soaking fabric in buttermilk and then laying it out on the ground to be whitened in sunlight for weeks. These areas, known as bleach fields, took up enormous spreads of land. The 19th century Industrial Revolution created a far greater demand for both soap and bleach. Industry was blackening entire cities, and as skies and clothes became covered with soot, it was becoming difficult to find enough space for bleach fields in urban areas. Another self-taught chemist, a Swede named Carl Wilhelm Scheele, in 1774, 12 years before his celebrated discovery of oxygen, first described a substance called chlorine and noted that it had the ability to bleach. Scheele was also one of the first to study the fermenting attributes of lactic acid. But it was not until 1786, 10 years after Scheele's observations on chlorine, that a practical application was pursued by the great French chemist Claude-Louis Berthollet, which showed that chlorine, when absorbed in potash, created a liquid bleach. Yet another salt-based industry was founded. In little more than a year, industrial bleaching became a major activity in the British textile industry. In 1810, Davy isolated chlorine and proved that it, too, was an element, a greenish gas which he named for the Greek word for greenish yellow. Chlorine has become an important industry. Not only used for bleach, water treatment, and sewage treatment, it is also an ingredient in plastics and artificial rubber. And as with so many scientific discoveries, a military application was found. Chlorine was the basis for gas warfare. In 1914, at the outbreak of World War I, chlorine gas was exploded in canisters, but later in the war, artillery shells filled with carbonyl chloride proved to be more effective. Known as mustard gas, the compound is credited with 800,000 casualties. Chemists and entrepreneurs were beginning to understand that salt was one of a very specific group of substances that were often found together, and that what we now call common salt was in many ways the least valuable of the group. In 1744, Guillaume-François Rouelle, a member of the French Royal Academy of Sciences, wrote a definition of a salt that has endured. He said that a salt was any substance caused by the reaction of an acid and a base. For a long time, the existence of acids and bases had been known, but little understood. Acids were sour-tasting and had the ability to dissolve metal. Bases felt soapy. But Rouelle understood that an acid and a base have a natural affinity for each other, because nature seeks completion, and as with all good couples, acids and bases make each other more complete. Acids search for an electron that they lack, and bases try to shed an extra one. Together they make a well-balanced compound, a salt. In common salt, the base, or electron donor, is sodium, and the acid, or electron recipient, is chloride. It turned out that salt was a microcosm for one of the oldest concepts of nature and the order of the universe. From the 4th century BC, Chinese belief in the forces of yin and yang, to most of the world's religions, to modern science, to the basic principles of cooking, there has always been a belief that two opposing forces find completion, one receiving a missing part and the other shedding an extra one. A salt is a small but perfect thing. Much of the new interest in salt, like the early Chinese experiments with saltpeter, was focused on providing the military with ever more efficient ways to blow up people and things. In the 19th century, it was discovered that potassium chlorate produced a bigger explosion than traditional gunpowder, potassium nitrate. And magnesium had even more impressive explosive properties. This science gave birth to a broad range of industries, some of which also poisoned people. The Leblanc process, invented by 18th century French surgeon Nicolas Leblanc, treated salt with sulfuric acid to produce sodium carbonate. Along the way, it also gave off hydrogen chloride fumes and solid calcium sulfide. The calcium sulfide released the classic rotten egg smell of sulfur, to add to the black clouds and cinder of industrial centers. Hydrogen chloride fumes were worse. The gas from these manufactories is of such a deleterious nature as to blight anything within its influence, and is alike baneful to health and property. The herbage in the fields in their vicinity is scorched. The gardens yield neither fruit nor vegetables. Many flourishing trees have lately become rotten, naked sticks. Cattle and poultry droop and pine away. It tarnishes the furniture in our houses, and when we are exposed to it, which is of frequent occurrence, we are afflicted with coughs and pains in the head. Hearings at the Town Council of Newcastle upon Tyne, January 9, 1839. Saltworks, once contaminated by coal smoke and pan scale, expanded their line of products and became far more toxic. By the 1880s, the age of canals had come to an end with the development of railroads, and salt was no longer profitable in upstate New York. But salt was used to manufacture soda ash, caustic soda, bicarbonate of soda, and other chemicals. The salt center of Syracuse was turned into a chemical manufacturing center, temporarily saving the industry but nearly destroying Lake Onondaga with pollution. Chlorine is a component of some of the deadliest industrial pollutants, including polychlorinated biphenyls, which are more infamously known by their abbreviation, PCBs. On May 15, 1918, the section of the Erie Canal that ran through Syracuse was closed. 5 years later, the city bought the canal property for $800,000 and covered it over, creating Erie Boulevard. Soon, even the salt industry vanished. In the 1930s, the salt works were cleared away, and the city struggled to clean up the lake so that the area could be used for recreation. Chapter 19. The Mythology of Geology. Chemistry changed forever the way we see salt. But it was inventions in other fields that radically changed the role of salt in the world. Salt for food will never become completely obsolete, but since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, it has steadily become less important. The first blow was from a Paris cook named Nicolas Appert. Considering the significance of his invention, little is known of Appert. Some think his first name may have been François. He was a confectioner who believed that sealing food tightly in a jar and then heating the jar would destroy the substance that caused food to rot, a substance that he termed ferment. Among the first salt fish customers to be lost to Appert's ideas was Napoleon's Navy. In 1803, Appert persuaded the Navy to try his broth, beef and vegetables, all preserved in glass jars by his heating and sealing process. The Navy was pleased. A report stated, "The beans and green peas, both with and without meat, have all the freshness and flavor of hand-picked vegetables." Anyone who has ever eaten canned beans or peas may suspect some hyperbole here, but for sailors who had never had vegetables on their long voyages, Appert's treats seemed a wondrous invention. Grimond de la Ranière, the leading gastronomic writer of France at the time, praised Appert's food. Appert's 1809 book, The Art of Preserving All Kinds of Animal and Vegetable Substances for Several Years, was widely read and even translated into English. Only months after its publication, Peter Durand, a Londoner, was granted a patent for preserving food. He admitted that his ideas came from an unnamed foreigner who was probably Appert. Actually, in 1807, an Englishman named Thomas Saddington had demonstrated a similar process. But what is important about Durand is that along with glass and pottery, he mentioned in his list of possible containers for preserved foods, tin and other metals. Brian Donkin, a visionary early British industrialist, realized, perhaps better than Durand had, the potential of the tin idea. He had founded the Dartford Iron Works, and in 1805 he helped finance the first industrial papermaking machine. After Durand received his patent in 1809, Donkin founded Donkin, Hall, and Gamble, the first British canning plant, across the Thames from the City of London. It became the outfitter of famous expeditions such as the Arctic expeditions of William Edward Parry in the 1820s. Toward the end of the Napoleonic Wars, the British Navy began experimenting with canned food from Donkin, Hall, and Gamble. At first, canned food was used as special provisions for those on sick list, but by the 1830s it had become part of general provisions. Unfortunately, the can opener had not yet been invented. Sailors were issued special knives with which to pry open the cans. In 1830, a canning plant was built in La Turballe, the sardine fishing town across the opening of the Garonne swamp from Le Croisic. The plant flourished, and gradually most of the area's salt fish business collapsed, unable to compete with canned products. In time, much of the French Atlantic salt fish industry disappeared. A similar fate befell much of the salted herring industry to the north and anchovy industry to the south. A 20th century invention dealt an even worse blow to the salt fish industry, and for that matter, to fish. The idea of using cold to preserve food had been much thought about in the 19th century. In 1800, Thomas More, an American engineer who wanted to keep his butter cool during the 20-mile journey between his Maryland farm and the market in Washington, D.C., the newly created capital, built a wooden box with a metal butter container inside surrounded by ice. He then stuffed the box with rabbit fur. According to his account, his butter, firm and chilled even in summer, sold well in Washington. As early as the 1820s, fish was sometimes packed in ice in an attempt to preserve its freshness. American farmers asked themselves if ice could not somehow be used like salt. Salting in snow was discussed by Sarah Josepha Hale. As the editor of Godey's Ladies' Book from 1837 to 1877, years in which this widely read magazine almost never mentioned the Civil War because war was not the business of ladies, Hale was regarded as one of America's most influential women. An excellent way to keep fresh meat during the winter is practiced by the farmers in the country, which they term salting in snow. Take a large clean tub, cover the bottom 3 or 4 inches thick with clean snow, then lay pieces of fresh meat, spare ribs, fowls, or whatever you wish to keep, and cover each layer with 2 or 3 inches of snow, taking particular care to fill snow into every cranny and crevice between the pieces, and around the edges of the tub. Fowl must also be filled inside with the snow. When the tub is filled, the last layer must be snow, pressed down tight. Then cover the tub, which must be kept in a cold place. The colder, the better. The meat will not freeze, and unless there happen to be a long spell of warm weather, the snow will not thaw, but the meat remain as fresh and juicy when it is taken out to be cooked as when it was first killed. Sarah Josepha Hale, The Good Housekeeper, 1841. An eccentric New Yorker named Clarence Birdseye was troubled by the idea of packing food in ice, because the ice melted and the resulting water created an environment in which bacteria could flourish. Bored with New York office jobs, Birdseye had moved to Labrador with his wife, Eleanor, and their son to earn his living trapping furs. He noted, as was long known by the indigenous people there, that when fish are caught in Labrador in the wintertime, they instantly freeze, and that if kept this way for several weeks, when thawed, they will taste fresh. The Birdseye home became very different from other Labrador households. Cabbages were frozen in the windows, and fish were swimming in the bathtub, as Birdseye experimented. He observed how the harsh Labrador wind acted on wet food, freezing it very rapidly so that bacteria had no opportunity to develop. Soon he was in Washington, unveiling his new technology, the fast freezing process. Birdseye went to the unveiling equipped with a block of ice, a fan, and a bucket of brine, all the necessary ingredients for a homemade Labrador winter. He made the brine from calcium chloride, which after experimentation, he found kept the temperature lower than sodium chloride. Fast freezing worked, Birdseye discovered, because of a principle every salt maker knew. Rapid crystallization creates small crystals, and slow crystallization produces large ones. Because the ice crystals in rapidly frozen food were small, they did not interfere with the tissue structure, and so better preserved the food in its original state. In 1925, Birdseye moved to Gloucester, Massachusetts, the leading New England cod fishing port, and established a frozen seafood company. Birdseye's invention came at a time when the demand for salted fish was in rapid decline in both the United States and Britain. The railroad, faster transportation, and better market systems had introduced more people to fresh fish. By 1910, only 1% of the fish landed in New England was cured with salt. By 1928, 1 million pounds of food frozen in the Birdseye method was being sold in the United States. Most of it was being sold by Birdseye, who managed to find a buyer for his company just before the 1929 market crash. The company became General Foods, modeling the name after General Electric and General Motors, leaders in their respective industries. Birdseye once said, "I do not consider myself a remarkable person. I am just a guy with a very large bump of curiosity and a gambling instinct." By the time he died at age 69, he had patented 250 inventions, including dozens of devices and gadgets to improve the operation of his frozen food process. He invented a light bulb with a built-in reflector and a gooseneck lamp. But he will always be remembered for frozen food. Fast freezing had at last made the unsalted fish people wanted available to everyone, even far inland. Soon fishing vessels, instead of salting their catch at sea, were freezing it on board. Most salted foods became delicacies instead of necessities. The age of industrial engineering brought inventions to a salt industry that had been slow to develop new ideas. Most salt works had been started as small operations by individualists who found original solutions to their technical problems. Some ideas, like the natural gas of Sichuan, had enduring and far-reaching applications. Some ideas, such as little paddle wheels with bells in the freshwater canals of Lorraine salt works, to ensure by their tintinnabulation that the canals were not mixing with brine canals, were purely local. Still other ideas were based on cheap, often family labor. One of the more curious examples of this was the grow, a 16th-century machine for lifting brine from storage tanks by means of a basket on one end of a lever. On the other end were ropes. Women would grab the ropes and swing off them like children at an amusement park, their weight hoisting the buckets on the other end. Another example, using cheap labor, in this case slave labor, was a human-powered wheel used to pump brine. In medieval Sasso Maggiore, men, chained at the neck, walked on the slats of huge wheels as on a treadmill. In Halle, brine was lifted on a wheel powered by 12 men. The man wheel was used in Europe until the 19th century. In 1840, a 28-pond salt works near Cape Ann, Massachusetts, supplemented the power from windmills on calm days by pumping brine by means of a 15-foot in diameter, 5-foot wide wheel with buckets on its outer rim. The wheel was powered by a large bull that walked inside the wheel. Pumping brine was one of the most important engineering problems confronting salt makers, and it inspired many inventions. The first engine, the steam engine, which led the way to the Industrial Revolution, was invented in 1712 by an Englishman, Thomas Newcomen, and used exclusively for pumping water. The engine and its subsequent improvements were embraced by British and American salt makers, who had abundant fuel, mostly coal. In Germany, however, where there was not enough sunlight for solar evaporation and most of the springs had relatively weak brine, the cost of fuel was the central problem. In the 17th century, the Germans, learning that the salt at Sasso Maggiore was more profitable than that in Germany, had sent investigators to Parma, convinced they would find new fuel-economizing technology. Instead, they found that the Parmigianos simply charged a great deal more for their salt. For the Germans, steam engines consumed too much fuel. Salt inspired innovations in transportation, perhaps none more impressive than the canals of northern Germany, Cheshire, and the United States. The Anderton boat lift lowered entire loaded salt barges 50 feet from the Cheshire Canal system down to the level of the River Weaver, which ran into the mouth of the Mersey across the bay from Liverpool. Built in 1875 to link the Trent and Mersey Canal to the River Weaver, it originally lowered the barges by a cantilevered hydraulic system based on counterweights and water power. But salt spills eventually turned the canal brackish and corroded the machine. In the 20th century, an electric motor was added. But it was in the technology of drilling that salt producers had a momentous impact on the modern world. For a long time, the percussion drilling techniques of the Chinese were the leading invention. All percussion drilling, from early Sichuan to 19th century Okinawa, essentially consisted of a chisel with a long shaft being whacked by a kind of hammer. In the 16th and 17th centuries, Europeans began using a rotary drill. They attached extension rods, known as boring rods, which, in 1640, enabled the Dutch to drill 216 feet under Amsterdam to reach a source of fresh water. In the early 19th century, the drilling proved so successful at Kanawha that many Americans began deep drilling projects in search of salt. An improved connection between the driving shaft and the drill shaft was developed in the United States. This connection was called a jar because it was designed to better withstand the jar of the pounding shaft. Europeans quickly adopted the American invention. Jars had actually been used centuries earlier by the Chinese, but Westerners did not know this. At the time of the American invention of the jar, a Western missionary, one Father Imbert, had gone to China to study the ancient wells of Sichuan. He reported on more than 1,000 ancient wells drilled to great depths and brine lifted in long bamboo buckets. He also observed that the Chinese had elaborate techniques for recovering broken drill shafts. In the West, such obstructions were often the cause of a well being abandoned. In the late 17th century, when coal prospectors drilled into the Cheshire earth and found rock salt, it was the scientists, not the salt merchants, who were excited by the find. It demonstrated how improved drilling might someday open up an entirely new scientific field. Geology, the study of the earth. Almost another century and a half would pass before England had its first systematic curriculum in the study of geology, established not by a geologist, but by Humphrey Davy. Long before there were geologists, there were natural philosophers who contemplated the structure of the earth. Some of their best ideas remained unproved and unembraced. 1900 years before Columbus's voyages, Aristotle wrote that the earth was round. An 11th century AD Persian physician, Avicenna, author of some 100 works on medicine and philosophy, wrote about land being formed by prehistoric flooding, erosion, sediment deposits, and the metamorphosis of soft rock. He might have been remembered as the father of geology if more people had understood what he was talking about, but it would take centuries for the scientific world to catch up with him. Throughout the Renaissance, new ideas were presented on the Earth's formation by thinkers in various fields, including Leonardo da Vinci, who opined that fossils were not, as widely supposed, placed in the rock by the devil, but were formed by trapped plants and animals metamorphosing in the soil. In the mid-16th century, George Bauer, a German with the pen named Georgius Agricola, wrote on the origin of mountains, minerals, and underground water. His 1556 work De Re Metallica was the most complete work to date and for centuries to come on techniques for mining and producing metals and minerals, including salt. Long before it was called geology, a number of geological debates persisted. One of them was on the origin of salt. Was a giant bed of salt at the bottom of the sea keeping ocean water salted? Or, as some believed, did the tremendous pressure at great depths so squeeze water that it turned salty? Another theory held that salt did not come from the ocean at all, but that salt on earth was carried to sea by rivers. In the 17th century, René Descartes asserted that sweet water was soft and would evaporate, but salt particles were hard and would remain, and that was why the sea remained salty. According to his theory, the soft part of the ocean, the fresh water, was absorbed in the earth's pores and then reappeared in the form of freshwater rivers, streams, and lakes. The earth not only had pores, but also had cracks, and these fissures were wide enough to let in the seawater, particles and all. This seawater usually formed brine springs. But some of these fissures were dead ends and did not lead to springs. The seawater that seeped into such places hardened into rock salt. One 18th century theory held that the source of natural brine was that gypsum saturated with seawater leached salt. But another theory was that gypsum, a soft mineral common in most of the world, turned into salt. Water, according to this hypothesis, is salty in its natural state. The real question was, what caused fresh water not to be salty? Robert Hooke, the 17th century philosopher, whose many scientific accomplishments include originating the word cell for the basic organism, concluded that salt came from the air. Others concluded that salt came from alkali, which turns out to be true, since alkali are bases. Some combined the two, concluding that salt was caused by the alkali in seawater mixing with the salt in the air. The Germans tried to understand their many brine springs. Did brine come from rock salt below, as already appeared to be the case in Cheshire? Christian Kefferstein, a Prussian lawyer, self-taught scientist, and author of a 7-volume geologic study, was convinced that the discovery of rock salt near a number of brine springs was coincidental. Rock salt, he believed, came from certain rocks. In the 18th and 19th centuries, the raging geologic debate pitted Neptunism against Plutonism. The Neptunists, led by German mineralogist Abraham Gottlob Werner, believed that the source of all bedrock was a common ancient sea. According to Plutonism, most rock had hardened from a huge molten rock mass. Neptunism held that salt came from the sea, and Plutonism insisted it was volcanic in origin. In 1775, William Bowles used the Salt Mountain of Cardona to argue against the Neptunism theory of salt. Logic indicated that such a huge mountain of solid rock was probably not left over from the ocean. Several others confirmed that this Pyrenees-sized mountain was solid salt, or mostly salt, 70%, one study contended, and that such a mass must have metamorphosized out of other rock. Eventually, Neptunism was rejected because both granite and basalt were proved to be of volcanic origin. But did that mean that Plutonism was right about salt being formed by volcanoes? In the 19th century, Europeans became extremely curious about the structure of salt deposits in other parts of the world, such as the Dead Sea. Thomas Jefferson was constantly questioned by Europeans about American salt formations, some of them mythical structures rumored to exist in the wilderness of the northern reaches of the Louisiana Purchase. As drilling improved, it became clear that the earth possessed huge underground salt deposits, and that far from being rare, rock salt was very common. By the end of the 18th century, many geologists were convinced that most of Central Europe was sitting on an enormous salt deposit. To a large extent, they were right. The same salt deposit that feeds Alsace and Lorraine extends through Germany to the Austrian Salzkammergut. The thick layer of salt underneath Cheshire starts in northern Ireland and runs into northern Europe. Onondaga County, New York, is part of an enormous salt field that stretches across the entire Great Lakes region, providing rock salt mines under the city of Detroit, in Cleveland, and in Ontario. There is still not complete agreement on the formation of many of the Earth's great salt deposits, but they are generally agreed to have had their origin in oceans rather than volcanoes, though there is still no set explanation for the saltiness of the sea. Geologists, both out of curiosity and in search of salt, looked for salt domes, areas like Avery Island that had deep, pure sodium chloride deposits, forced by the pressure of shifting plates, to mushroom up from the depths and break the Earth's surface in a dome shape. The history of salt dome theories begins with Thomassy, the Frenchman who said that Avery Island was rock salt. He stated that the salt there comes from a volcano of water, mud, and gas. This plutonistic theory of the salt's volcanic origin was later rejected by most geologists. In 1867, C.A. Gossmann, reporting to the American Bureau of Mines, theorized that the salt under Avery Island resulted from brine springs ascending through older deposits of bedded salt. According to Gossmann, brine rises from deep within the earth, moving through the earth's fissures and crystallizing near the surface. Salt prospectors were able to find salt domes by recognizing the rounded shape that protruded above the earth's surface. They would drill in such spots, which invariably yielded brine, but often the salt was so contaminated with blackish muck that it was of little commercial value. In 1901, two men, Petit O'Higgins and Anthony Lucas, ignored the advice of geologists and started drilling a Texas salt dome called Spindletop. No one ever looked at salt domes the same way again. No longer were terms like well and drill rig to conjure up the image of salt. Spindletop had spawned the age of petroleum. Such an age had been promised in 1859 outside Titusville, Pennsylvania, where Edwin Drake, after studying the drilling techniques of salt producers, drilled 69.5 feet and, everyone's surprise but his, hit oil. He began producing 25 barrels per day, and many started to believe that oil would be an abundant U.S. resource. But subsequent drilling, mostly in the East, yielded little. By 1866, 7 years after Titusville, when salt was discovered in Ontario, it was a different age. Canada had not produced much salt, but instead of excitement about a rich new salt field, there were high hopes that oil had been found. In Goderich, Ontario, Samuel Platt organized the Goderich Petroleum Company, which began work on the north bank of the Maitland River, drilling 686 feet through gray limestone. There was no sign of oil, and the stockholders who had provided $10,000 in startup money wanted to abandon the project. But the county council offered Platt a bonus of $1,000, and the city offered $500, provided he continue to a depth of 1,000 feet. At 964 feet from the collar of the hole, he hit solid rock salt. The Goderich Salt Company was founded with 52 boiling kettles, and the Ontario salt fields have become one of the most productive salt works in the modern world. By the time Higgins and Lucas began drilling at Spindletop, hopes for American oil had faded. But Spindletop changed the thinking of geologists, chemists, engineers, and economists because it showed that a single spot, a corner of a single salt dome, could by itself produce enormous quantities of oil in a short period of time. In its first 65 years, Spindletop produced 145 million barrels of oil. As a result of Spindletop, the United States surpassed Russia, the largest oil producer at the time. Also because of Spindletop, geologists took a new look at salt domes. Because salt is impenetrable, organic material gets trapped next to the salt and slowly decomposes into oil and gas. For this reason, oil, gas, or both are frequently found on the edge of salt. The 2,000-year-old mystery of Sichuan was answered. After Spindletop, more oil was found along the Texas-Louisiana coast in such places as Sour Lake in 1902, Humble in 1905, and Goose Creek in 1908. The United States took the lead in a drilling technology that was now in demand all over the world, as geologists searched the globe for likely salt domes to drill. Many of them were found in the Persian Gulf. In 1908, oil was found in Persia, now Iran, in the places where Herodotus had written about salt. Exploration continued in North America. Few believed Columbus Joyner when he began drilling for oil on an unheard-of geologic structure he called the Overton Anticline. It is now known that his theory of geology was completely wrong, but fortunately at the time, no one could disprove it. They laughed at him, and he drilled anyway, and found the largest oil field in North America, the East Texas Field. In a less corporate age, oilmen used to take glee in pointing out that the three most important discoveries in the history of American oil, Titusville, Spindletop, and the East Texas Field, were all drilled against the advice of geologists. As Brownrigg had predicted in the mid-18th century, old arts are improved and new ones daily invented. The quest for salt had turned unexpected corners and created dozens of industries. Chapter 20. The Soil Never Sets on... When the British Empire was at its height, Liverpool salt was the salt of the empire, a prestigious product known all over the world. As in Cardona, Hallein, and Wieliczka, a visit to the Cheshire salt mines was a special treat for visiting aristocrats. These elite guests were lowered into the mines in enormous brine buckets. The candlelit bucket passed through the narrow shaft, and when it came out at the mine below, the visitors were greeted by the word welcome, spelled out by the workers with candles on the salt floor. According to local legend, when the Tsar of Russia visited England, he dined beneath Cheshire by the light of 1,000 candles. It was the canals leading to Liverpool that had given Cheshire a global market. Not only was salt ballast for the voyage to America to pick up cotton and other imports for British industry, but because the port of Liverpool was deeply involved in the slave trade, ships regularly bound for West Africa needed an outbound cargo. Nigeria bought Cheshire salt until 1968, when that market collapsed with the Biafran Civil War. By 1890, besides the lucrative foreign market, Cheshire supplied 90% of British salt. In Cheshire, a good income could be had by anyone who could buy or lease a small plot of land near one of the witches, and who had the relatively small amount of capital needed to drill a hole in that ground and set up some wide, flat iron pans over a coal-burning furnace. Because the chimneys at Cheshire Brine Works were not built high enough for the wind to carry the soot and glowing cinders away, workers and townspeople lived amid burning black clouds. The smoke and smother of weary Winsford, as one newspaper described it in the 1880s. An 1878 Royal Commission reported that air pollution was choking the local vegetation. Salt producers were fined for the pollution, but this did not alter their practices. One producer told a board of inquiry that he would continue until the fines drove him out of business, and then he would relocate elsewhere. Salt did not provide an easy life. Often a man would rent a pan, and he, his wife, and children would ensure the maximum profit by working around-the-clock shifts to keep the pan in constant production. Children would start working at the salt pans at the age of 9. Women would go back and forth between the pans and their homes, alternating household work with salt making. A normal work day for a salaried salt worker was 12 hours, but it was often much longer. Some were paid by the hour and others by the quantity of salt they produced. Reform came slowly. An 1867 law forbade women and children to work between 6 p.m. and 6 a.m., Factory inspectors began protesting the working conditions for women, saying the work was too physically strenuous. And the public was scandalized when inspectors revealed that in the hot boiling houses, men and women worked together, the men stripped to the waist and the women, dresses removed, in their underwear and petticoats. An 1876 inquiry demanded that girls under 18 be barred from salt works. Robert Baker, one of the inspectors, argued for shorter work weeks for men. He told the Board of Inquiry, "The fact is the men never see beds but on Saturday night." For centuries, Nantwich had been the leading Cheshire salt town. But in the early 20th century, geologists discovered that the most important deposits were under Northwich and Winsford, where the thickness of the rock salt is as much as 180 feet, and even at its thinnest, no less than 48 feet. The strange sinkholes that had been sporadically appearing in the 18th century had become, by the late 19th century, a regular phenomenon. Not so much in Nantwich, but in and around Northwich and Winsford. Every year, new spots in meadows, pastures, and even towns collapsed. The holes caught rainfall and made small lakes. Toward the end of the century, a lake of more than 100 acres suddenly appeared near Northwich. Sometimes saltworks made use of the newly developed holes, filling them with ash or lime waste. Just one more pollutant in an area black with coal smoke. The brine makers tried to continue blaming the sinkholes on the rock salt miners, saying sinking was caused by abandoned mine shafts. This had worked better when rock salt was a new discovery, but in the 19th century it became obvious that the location of the sinkholes bore no relation to the location of mine shafts, and as sinking became more frequent, there were not enough shafts to explain the number of occurrences. On the other hand, there was an exact correlation between the increase in brine production and the increase in sinkholes. The sinking was starting to wreak havoc with railroad lines and even to threaten bridges. In Northwich and Winsford, homes and buildings collapsed as the ground gave way underneath them. By 1880, 400 buildings had been destroyed or damaged in Northwich alone. At Winsford, a new church was condemned as dangerous. Water mains, sewer lines, and gas pipes were continually breaking, and the costs of repairing them were draining municipal budgets. Shop after shop was condemned and torn down. A passing traveler described Northwich. A number of miniature valleys seemed across the road, and in their immediate neighborhood the houses are, many of them, far out of the perpendicular. Some overhang the street as much as 2 feet, whilst others lean on their neighbors and push them over. Chimney stacks lean and become dangerous, whilst doors and windows refuse to open and close properly. Many panes of glass are broken in the windows. The walls exhibit cracks from the smallest size up to a width of 3 or 4 inches. And in the case of brick arches over doors and passages, the key brick has either fallen out or is about to do so, and in many cases, short beams have been substituted for the usual arch. In the inside, things are not much better. The ceilings are cracked and the cornices fall down, whilst the plaster on the walls and the paper covering it exhibit manifold chinks and crevices. The doors either refuse to open without being continually altered by the joiner, or they swing back into the room the moment they are unlatched. Chambers Journal, 1879. With an English flair for genteel euphemism, the growing disaster was labeled subsidence. Subsidence in Cheshire was becoming a subject of considerable amusement around England, spawning Cheshire jokes. But it also drew religious fanatics who went to Cheshire to deliver sermons to the crowds who came to gawk at the holes. The preachers would stand at the edge of the craters looking down into akimbo boiling houses and broken smokestacks and warn that this was what hell would look like. The truth was that too much brine was being pumped too rapidly from underneath Cheshire. Hundreds of ambitious, small-scale entrepreneurs were making salt. They became extremely competitive. Some would pump additional brine out and dump it in the canals just to try to deprive their competitors. The brine that flows over the salt rock of Cheshire is a saturated solution, 1/4 salt, and so it is incapable of absorbing any more. But as brine was removed, fresh groundwater took its place, and this water would absorb salt until the brine was once again 1/4 salt. The problem was that if large quantities of brine were removed, they were replaced with large quantities of fresh water that hungrily absorbed considerable amounts of salt. Once that started happening, fresh water began eroding the natural salt pillars that supported the space between the salt rock and the surface. When a pillar collapsed, the earth above it sank. But even in the 19th century, when this process was understood, it was difficult to know whom to blame. The area around the salt works might remain solid, even though the brine it was pumping was causing the earth to collapse 4 miles away. Two or three other salt works, though closer to the hole than the culprit, might have caused no damage at all. Identifying the culprit was an important legal issue, since hundreds of people, many of them not in the salt industry, had lost their property and were demanding compensation. Unable to name a defendant, they could not pursue a legal action. Could they charge the salt industry in general? Citizens formed committees and went to Parliament, proposing a bill that compensated victims for the damages caused by the salt industry. Property owners, citing a long-standing principle of British law that the owner of land owned the subsoil, claimed that not only was their property being destroyed, but they were being robbed of the rock salt that they owned. The brine pumpers were sucking up their rock salt from under their own sinking property. The salt producers argued, with typical 19th-century capitalist confidence, that locals were already being compensated by the economic benefits of having the salt industry. They denied that the subsidence was caused by pumping, insisting that the sinkholes were a natural phenomenon that would continue even without pumping. These arguments prevailed, and in 1880, the bill was defeated. In 1887, a group of London financiers raised £4 million to buy up salt works for a company called the Salt Union Limited. The company, founded by 7 entrepreneurs without prior connections to the salt industry, wanted to buy up all British salt production and become the largest industrial company in England. Both the London Times and The Economist warned that such a giant could not maintain a monopoly on an industry whose raw material was so common and initial investment requirements so modest. In Cheshire, with its long tradition of individualists and small private operators, many were angered at the sight of a corporate giant buying out local salt makers one by one. But industry leaders felt that the salt union was a workable solution to a sector that had too many participants. The rate of brine pumping spurred by this competition was in danger of literally sinking them all. The low salt prices of the late 1880s gave a further incentive to selling out. 65 salt producers sold out to the salt union. They were not only from Cheshire, but from neighboring Staffordshire, Worcestershire, northeastern England, and Northern Ireland. The salt union had cornered 85% of British salt production. But most analysts believed that it had greatly overpaid to acquire these companies. Nevertheless, the company was highly profitable its first few years, before going into a steep decline. Not until 1920 did profits again reach the level of 1890. In 1891, when the Cheshire Salt District's compensation bill again came before Parliament, the salt union used the arguments that the independent salt producers had used a decade earlier, that the people were being compensated by the economic benefits of having a salt industry, and that the sinking was a natural phenomenon that would have occurred without salt works. But now, the salt union provided a target, a single entity that was clearly responsible, a defendant. The local citizenry spent a fortune promoting the bill, and both the salt union and its shareholders spent a fortune fighting it. It passed, though, and within 10 years the salt union itself was applying for damages, saying its properties had suffered subsidence from the pumping of others. In the long run, the Compensation Act probably helped the salt union. It created the Cheshire Brine Subsidence Compensation Board, which was financed by a flat tax on salt producers. The cost of the tax was onerous for small operations and insignificant for large ones. The small-scale producers regarded the brine board, as it was known, as another attempt by big salt to drive them out. The brine board established a building code that had to be